The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
Within an hour, there was nine of them drowned.
The centenary of the feathered lifeboat disaster.
O Lord, save this woman, thy servant, who putteth her trust in thee.
We hear about the controversial practice of churching after childbirth. Also, animal sacrifice in ancient Greece. And there'll be much more. We begin this evening with the feathered lifeboat disaster, which claimed the lives of nine local men and one Norwegian 100 years ago this week. In a brief respite from last week's storms, Orla Rappel travelled to the village of Feathered in County Wexford to hear this story of bravery and tragedy.
Well, we're about a mile from the village. Where the Keurig Islands are here now, to the left of those, that's Cullenstown. And out further east, you're looking into Kilmore. That's Kilmore Quay over there. It's Bay, this is Feathered Bay, right around. Cullenstown is over here to the left. That's Cullenstown in there. That's where the bodies would have washed in.
The sun is hitting the sea as it rocks lightly into Feathered Bay in County Wexford, making it hard to fathom what people saw here along the small dock 100 years ago. On February 20th, 1914, the steel-hulled Mexico, a Norwegian schooner bound for Liverpool with timber, was in distress at the barren, windswept islets, the Kirrocks, off the mouth of Banno Bay. A group of feathered men strived to rescue the crew of the Mexico.
And the 14 men set out for the Kirrocks, and within an hour of getting there was nine of them drowned.
On board the lifeboat, the Helen Blake that day, were two first cousins, Richard and William Bird, and their uncle, Christopher Bird. Today, some of the relations of the Birds lost at sea still live in Feathered.
Richard Bird was my granduncle. Christopher Bird was my great-granduncle, and William Bird was a first cousin of Richard Bird.
This is Owen Bird, a man who grew up hearing the story of his family members and their colleagues' bravery, a bravery that influenced him.
And that's actually why I joined the lifeboat myself.
However, the experience of the men on the Helen Blake lifeboat would have been very different to how a rescue is carried out today.
It would be hard for us to imagine, because they would have gone out in an ordinary rowing boat in treacherous conditions. It would have been sleet showers, they would have been cold and wet. They would have only had life jackets made from cork. So they would have been wet and cold from the start of the service. So it's completely different. You couldn't compare what would happen today with what happened 100 years ago.
Weather conditions were atrocious on Friday, February 20th, 1914. Sleet and rain and bouts of snow hit the stormy seas. The lifeboat Helen Blake was being kept as usual in a brick shed just up from the dock.
But the lifeboat was kept in this house.
Liam Ryan researched the story of the feathered lifeboat disaster for his book, The Awful Tragedy of the Helen Blake Lifeboat.
Christopher Bird was the cox. He actually removed took the lifeboat out on our carriage that very day, because the young farmers were planning on having a dance that evening. Now Christopher always kept the lifeboat in good shape. He always had the lifeboat house in good trim. It was always tidy, and he was, you know, considered to be a very meticulous type of man.
One of the lifeboat crew, Bill Banville, was grazing cattle when he saw the schooner Mexico in trouble near the Kirrocks. A maroon was fired and the crew gathered at this lifeboat shed.
Whatever happened to Bill Banville, no one knows, but he was late coming for the launch, even though he was the man who reported it. So he came running down the slipway, didn't have time to grab a life jacket, hopped into the boat. There was already, Richard Bird had never been in the lifeboat before, but because Bill Banville was nowhere to be found, he went ahead, but he chose to stay in the lifeboat, and the 14 men set out for the Kirrocks.
Bill Banville, the man who raised the alarm, and eight of his colleagues were killed that day.
Banville was quite badly mutilated in the, you know, that he must have struck rocks when he was thrown overboard. he was only identified some days after the event by the repairs he had made to his boots.
In fact, one of the crew of the Mexico, interviewed after he was rescued, said that the sea was almost red with blood. Richard Bird, who had never been in the lifeboat before, was one of the five who survived. They cling to the rocks of the Kirox until Monday morning, when along with the men of the Mexico, they were all finally rescued.
But Richard, even though he survived on the day, he was badly damaged. His spine was damaged and couldn't be repaired at the time. Medical advances weren't able to do anything for him, so he died within 2 years. You could say there was 10 victims, really, because his quality of life wasn't great afterwards. Like, he died within... Like, he would have been in pain for the couple of years with his back and his spine, and he just pined away. He was 24 when he died. And he died actually 6 days short of the second year anniversary of the tragedy. So he didn't get 2 years.
Orla Rappel reporting there from Feathered. For more on this story, I'm joined from our Waterford studio by author Liam Ryan and on the phone by Brian Murphy from the Rosslare Lifeboat Memorial Committee. Gentlemen, good afternoon to you. Good evening to you.
Good evening, Miles.
Good evening, Miles.
Now, this was the beginning, the attempted rescue. This was the beginning of a three-day ordeal for the survivors, for the if you can call them, the fortunate members of the crew of the Helen Blake who had not drowned, and for the local communities who attempted to rescue them. Liam, take the story up. It's day one. The survivors are clinging to the rocks. How many men are there and what happens next?
There was five feathered men and eight of the Mexico crew. But the first thing happened was that one of the Mexico crew, Antonio de la Cunha, aged 21, died from hypothermia. So the first thing the feathered men had to do was to dig a grave for the Norwegian sailor. And they found an old axe had washed in on the island, and they dug a shallow grave, covered the body with some sailcloth, and put sods over it to stop it blowing away.
And the body would have been removed at some point in the future. The body wasn't left there, was it?
No, the body was taken away the day after the rescue, the 24th of February.
Now, tell me about the other lifeboats then that were involved, lifeboats from that area.
Yeah, well, the Rosslare Ford lifeboat, the Kilmore lifeboat and the Dunmore East lifeboat were all involved in the rescue. But prior to that, the locals, Charlie Cook, Ned Bryan, Mark Spardon and the Peeler Kelly, got a hold of a couple of pair of horses and dragged the boat to the shore on Grange and attempted to rescue the men themselves before the lifeboats could even get there. But they were unsuccessful because the sea was so bad.
And I think people on the shore had a telescope and they were actually looking and they were trying to identify who had survived, who was on the island.
That's right, Miles. Yeah, they had a brass telescope set up just at the back of Feathered Dock near the ruin of an old windmill. But at that time, they didn't know how many people were on the Mexico, so they clung to the hope that there was an awful lot more of the feathered men alive than there actually was.
Well, that hope was dashed fairly quickly because bodies began to wash ashore fairly soon, didn't they?
That's right. While the lifeboats, the Dunmore East lifeboat and the Rosslare lifeboat, which was towed there by the Wexford tug, while they were trying to attempt a rescue on the islands, six bodies washed in on Collinstown Strand.
And identification was very difficult.
It was. Two of the bodies in particular were pretty mutilated, and there was some debate, as to one of them. They were convinced it was John Kelly, who was actually one of the survivors, but because Paddy Stafford had an unusual tuft of hair growing from one side of his head, that was the only thing that they identified him with. But that was only after the rescue had taken place, when they could actually discover that John Kelly was alive and well.
Now, when these lifeboats arrive from Rosslare Fort, from Dunmore East, and from Kilmore Quay, what were they able to do in the early hours after the tragedy?
Well, basically, they could do nothing. The seas were mountainous. The winds were strong. There was, you know, gale force winds. There was, you know, rain showers, hail showers, sleet. You know, they just could not get anywhere within 300 yards of the islands. And in the case of the Rosslare lifeboat, they had to give up at 4 o'clock, and the Wexford tugboat brought them back as far as Cheek Point. And the Dunmore East lifeboat went to Feathert Dock, and they were looked after by the local community while they stayed in on standby, you could say, in Feathert Village.
Meanwhile, on the island, you already have one death from hypothermia, and there must have been a risk that there would be others.
Yes, they had very little food. All they had was a couple of tinned, couple of tins of beef, I think even a tin of pineapples, you know, a bottle of wine and a half a bottle of brandy, which between, you know, all the men didn't go very far. So literally they lived on barnacles, and Gary Hendrick had some chaw tobacco, which I think he even shared among his fellow feathered men.
One of the things that interests me about this story is that they sent to London for an RNLI, in the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, inspector. What was all that about, and what did they think this person was going to be able to do, and how quickly would he get there?
Well, Commander Holmes was in the Royal National Lifeboat. You know, you have to remember that Ireland was still under British rule at the time. So it was the RNLI were desperately trying to save the men. Commander Holmes was a naval commander. He was dispatched to Ireland, and he called to Kilmore and decided that there was no way the rescue could be effected from Kilmore. So he was brought to Feathert, and he was I'd say he was 5 minutes in Feathert when he was down at the dock, and the Dunmore East lifeboat with Ned Bryan, the local hero, and Mark Spardon acting as a pilot, brought him out to view the scene and to see what they could do. His presence certainly gave the locals a lift. I think they felt that maybe with this guy from London that maybe, you know, something could happen. And, you know, he was quite keen. He got going early Monday morning, and with the locals, you know, Ned Bryan fired the rocket on the Monday morning, which, you know, effectively got a line to the island, which ultimately resulted in the rescue of the men.
And this was Holmes's contribution. This was his idea, wasn't it?
No.
Oh, it wasn't?
No, it was Ned Bryan was a local coast guard. You know, it should be remembered that, you know, the locals in Feathert did everything they could to get their men back. So it was a big effort of, you know, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, the Irish Coast Guards, and the locals. And Ned Bryan was, you know, somewhat ahead of his time, I suppose. He had this idea that if we could fire this rocket, you know, from the lifeboat and get a line to the island, well, you know, we could get, you know, the men off. And that had never been done anywhere before. So,
and how do they actually get them off? I mean, do they literally attach themselves to the line? How do they manage to exit the island?
Well, the Dunmore boat brought a small rowing boat with them, with two life belts and a life jacket in it. And once they had got the line to the island, they floated the boat down. But unfortunately, it was smashed on the rocks. But John McNamara managed to grab the life belts. And he said, to hell with this. He said, I'm giving this a go. And the men on the Dunmore East lifeboat towed John Mack through the surf. And when John Kelly saw that John McNamara had made it to the Fanny Harriet, he said, well, I'm out of here as well. Because at that stage, things were getting pretty critical. You know, of the five men that were rescued, you know, the five feathered men that were rescued, John Kelly was the only one that could actually walk ashore in Feathert that very day.
And when conditions were still very, very bad.
They were. But now, once the Dunmore men had got the two Feathert men on board the Fanny Harriet, the Rosslare boat had arrived from Cheek Point under tow with the Wexford tugboat, and they managed to get into a better position than the Dunmore boat. And they had a small rowing boat with them, and they the Dunmore boat gave them the line, you know, gave the Rosslare boat the line, and they managed to float a boat down with Ned, what's his name, Ned Wickham, Jem Wickham, and Bill Duggan, and they, you know, they managed then to take two men off at a time. They made five trips. At one stage, the boat got stove in on rocks. So Ned Wickham, the cox, threw them a loaf of bread, which they wrapped in an oilskin, stuffed the hole in the boat, and within, I think, slightly over an hour and a half, they had all men on board the Rosslare lifeboat.
Well, we'll talk about James Duggan, Wickham rather, and Bill Duggan in a few minutes. But Brian, we've heard there, Liam, talking about the Rosslare Fort lifeboat. And in case anybody presumably thinks that he's made a mistake and he really means the Rosslare Port lifeboat, he doesn't. He means the Rosslare Fort lifeboat, which is a place that up to a few days ago I'd never heard of. Why have I never heard of it?
Well, it's remarkable that a number of people in Rosslare haven't heard of it either, and yet it was the major part of the village through all the last centuries. Rosslare Fort was actually a fort back to the time of the Confederation of Kilkenny, where they had fortified Wexford Harbour. It lay at the end of the Rosslare Peninsula, which at that time was twice the length it is today. And it was a fortified structure which had cannons which defended the harbour, because Wexford Harbour at that time was a very, very busy trading port, traded with Britain and many ports in Europe and beyond. And it was literally littered with hundreds of schooners, which were the freighters of the day, bringing coal and bringing timber out, bringing coal in and various other items of trade. So Rosslare Fort at that time, Wexford Harbour had a very narrow entrance, and Rosslare Fort was opposite the Raven Point on one side, Rosslare Fort on the other. But over the years, and with the building of the slob lands within Wexford Harbour, it changed the tidal structures, and the actual peninsula of Rosslare began to erode. And in 1922, the first breach of the peninsula came through the peninsula into the Wexford Harbour and left Rosslare Fort as an island. And it eventually succumbed to the sea in 1925. It had been threatened for many years before that because they were being flooded. And actually, what Liam was saying, when Edward Wickham, the coxswain of the Rosslare boat, was attempting the rescue on the Keurig Islands, his second coxswain, Jim Wickham, his house was flooded on the fort back at home to a depth of 3 feet, and his family had to be evacuated while he was on the famous rescue of the Mexico and the lost crewmen of the Helen Blake.
It's extraordinary that the village was essentially washed away in its entirety in the 1920s. Now, people have an image of what a lifeboat looks like today. Describe what a lifeboat looked like 100 years ago.
Well, at the time, the Rosslare boat was a boat called the James Stevens, and she was what was known as a pulling sailing lifeboat, because it was basically it was a larger boat than the Helen Blake, because it was more or less a seagoing lifeboat, which was moored at sea all the time. It wasn't a housed boat. It was, I don't know, say 4 feet out of the water, up to the gunwale. And it was just an arrangement of ropes hanging out of it. It could sail, it could raise sail, and could make good speed at sail. It was rowed by 10 men, who were usually a recruited local crew from the area. And the only way it could get to the Keurigs, because it was a journey of 6.5 hours behind a tug, which was the tug Wexford, commanded by Lawrence Busher, Captain Busher. And that tug was a very heroic ship in its own right, because it really wasn't a seagoing tug. It was a tug which was used for moving the schooners around Wexford Harbour. And it was a steam paddle tug. It looked more like a Mississippi steamboat than anything else. So it was an amazing feat for those men to actually make the two ships to get from Rosslare Harbour. Because remember, Kilmore is between Rosslare Fort and the Keurigs, and the Kilmore boat made heroic efforts to launch, but it couldn't launch against the sea. But the only reason Rosslare could do it was that it had the tug to assist.
Now, we mentioned James Wickham and Bill Duggan, who were two of the rescuers from Rosslare Fort. They have a unique distinction, I think. This would make a wonderful trivia quiz trivia question at some point in the future. Yeah. Who are the only two men to have All-Ireland final medals without having actually participated in the All-Ireland final? And they are James Wickham and Bill Duggan. Why
That's
is
right.
that?
And the reason, Miles, that they have this distinction is that they were the two men on the Rosslare lifeboat who volunteered to man the punt, the little boat, which they got off the tug. The tug had a little punt which the crew used to go in and out to the harbour in. And they reckoned when they got the lifeboat moored off the island, the only way to approach the island to get the survivors off was to send in a small boat. So they put in the punt, and the two men that volunteered to do that were James Wickham and Bill Duggan. James Wickham was the second cox, and Bill Duggan was the bowman.
And now,
just to finish, they went in on the first run, and they managed to get two survivors off, and they brought them back to the lifeboat. But on the second run of the punt, they could only take two at a time. The second run, the punt actually hit the rocks and was holed. And the way they stopped it on the day was that they'd brought bread and an oil skin with them in case they got stranded on the island as well to actually share out among the survivors. And they used the bread and the oil skin to block the hole in the little punt. And they got two more men off and bracked with the hole in the punt. And then the decision was to be made. They had the rest of the people on the island, and they volunteered that they would go back again. And they made another four runs from the lifeboat into the island with the hole in the little boat and the bread just blocking the water from coming in.
Extraordinary heroism and extraordinary ingenuity. And Liam, there are apparently lots of photographs from this whole event. Why are there so many photographs in existence?
We're very lucky, really, because one of the Poole family from Waterford was actually married to the Hornicks in John's Hill in Feathered-on-Sea. And they obviously got word to Pools to come down to Feathered, and they more or less photographed the drama as it unfolded. And there's quite an extensive collection of photographs that exist about this tragedy. And it was, the local People newspaper published a full page of photographs, which kind of caught the imagination or the attention of the entire world. And there was money poured in from all quarters to the victims' families,
including from Norway in particular.
That's right.
And we've lots of those photos on our website, so visit rte.ie/historyshow if you want to have a look at those images. I know there are a number of centenary commemorations taking place in Feathered and in Rosslare, and those details of those are also on our website. I believe the Norwegian ambassador is coming down to Wexford for the commemorations. Brian Murphy of the Rosslare Lifeboat Memorial Committee and Liam Ryan, author of The Awful Tragedy of the Helen Blake Lifeboat. Many thanks for joining me with that fascinating story. Before the break, I want to mention the annual Holocaust Memorial Lecture, which takes place at Trinity College in Dublin next Tuesday, the 18th of February. The guest speaker is Dr. René Poznanski from Ben Gurion University, and he will be talking about being Jewish in World War II France. Details of that event are on our website. Join us after the break for Animal Sacrifice in Ancient Greece.